the fifth island that has safely and responsibly developed resources offshore in the Beaufort Sea.
The Trump administration approves the first oil production in federal Arctic waters. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Anchorage Police Department's move to the old LIO building is given the stamp of approval.
One of the more pressing needs that we have right now that we've talked to the body about several times is the need to store evidence.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
It's been 3 years since Shell abandoned its drilling program in the Chukchi Sea. But today, with much less fanfare, another company has taken a big step toward being the first to produce oil from federal Arctic waters. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has the details.
The Trump administration has handed a key approval to Hilcorp for a proposed oil development in the Beaufort Sea, east of Prudhoe Bay. Called the Liberty Project, Hilcorp aims to build a gravel island in shallow waters about 5 miles from the coast and drill for oil from there. A pipeline buried beneath the ocean floor will carry the oil to shore. In a presentation last month in Anchorage, Hilcorp's David Wilkins noted similar offshore oil developments are already built in the Arctic. The difference is that they're in waters controlled by the state and not the federal government.
This will be the fifth island that has safely and responsibly developed resources offshore in the Beaufort Sea.
According to Hilcorp, the Liberty Project will produce about 60,000 barrels of oil per day. The project is planned to start up in the early 2020s. Although Hilcorp has avoided the level of opposition Shell faced when it tried to work in Arctic federal waters, environmental groups have sent the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management a long list of concerns about the project. Among other things, they criticize the agency's analysis of the risk of an oil spill and Hilcorp's track record. The state has fined the company several times for safety violations in recent years. Earth Justice Attorney Jeremy Lieb acknowledged Liberty wouldn't be the first project of its kind in Arctic waters.
But I don't think the fact that an accident hasn't happened yet at sites in state waters is in any way dispositive of the fact that there's no risk of a spill here.
Lieb did not say if environmental groups are definitely planning on suing the federal government to halt Liberty. He says they still need time to look at the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's final decision to see if it's legally vulnerable. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Catholic Archdiocese in Anchorage announced today it will take a close look at possible sexual abuse within the church. The church is appointing an independent commission to review files from the last 50 years. Archbishop Paul Achin says the investigation will take into account personnel files and look into how sexual abuse accusations have been handled. It will encompass both clergy and lay people.
We need to be clear with our people that when accusations of abuse of minors and vulnerable adults comes to our desk, that we are taking care of business and we are taking care of victims.
The three commission members have broad backgrounds in law enforcement and criminal prosecutions. 10 years ago, the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks filed for bankruptcy after paying out millions of dollars in settlements to victims stretching back decades. Eichen says the current review was not prompted by new allegations in Alaska, but instead the climate throughout the country and recent revelations in other states.
One of my greatest hopes in making this report is that other victims that have not yet come forward to tell us their story will do so. I want this report to give confidence not just to the people of the church and to the broader public that this archbishop and this archdiocese is appropriately handling these cases.
The review will begin October 31st and is expected to be completed next year. The commission will deliver a report to Achin and members will help determine next steps. Achin says the church intends to make public the names of those credibly accused of misconduct. A Sitka man is facing felony charges for allegedly firing on a group of state trooper recruits as they were on an early morning run. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
54-year-old Vicente G. Carlos was indicted on 7 felony counts by a Sitka grand jury on Friday, October 19th. According to court records, shortly after 6 a.m. on the morning of October 9th, Carlos stopped his white Toyota Tacoma pickup truck on the side of Halibut Point Road near Blatchley Middle School, pointed a hunting rifle out the truck's window, and fired one round toward trooper recruits as they jogged back to the Public Safety Academy from their morning swim. A trooper sergeant following the recruits in an academy van notified Sitka police of the incident and began a pursuit of Carlos, who drove away at speeds allegedly topping 60 to 80 miles per hour toward Sitka's downtown neighborhood, through the roundabout and up Lake Street toward Sitka High School, all the while with the rifle barrel still pointed out of his truck's window. None of the nine trooper recruits were injured by the gunfire. A bullet hole was found in the side of the residence at 604 Halibut Point Road. Sitka police stopped Carlos near Sitka High School on Peterson Street and disarmed him. A welfare check of his wife, who was unharmed, led officers to the home of his brother-in-law, where they found the brother-in-law's roommate had been beaten, allegedly by Carlos, who had used the rifle butt to inflict numerous bruises and one deep laceration. The roommate told officers that he barely knew Carlos and had no idea why he was attacked. State troopers subsequently performed a series of tests to investigate recent drug use by Carlos. He allegedly tested positive for methamphetamine, and court records indicate that Carlos told officers he had used the drug at midnight the previous evening. The Sitka grand jury indicted Carlos on 3 counts of misconduct involving weapons and 4 counts of assault, all felonies. Carlos remains in custody at the Sitka jail. He was arraigned in Sitka Superior Court on October 22nd. A trial date was set in January 2019. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Anchorage Police Department is moving to a new home, taking over an embattled downtown building that's been vacant since it was abandoned by state lawmakers. The Anchorage Assembly gave its final stamp of approval for APD to relocate to a 6-story office building designed to house the state's Legislative Information Office, or LIO. The Anchorage Community Development Authority, a quasi-governmental entity, bought the building this summer from an out-of-state bank for $14 million. Now it'll be the landlord collecting just over $132,000 a month in rent from APD. Police Chief Justin Dahl says the department has outgrown its 1980s era headquarters near the UMed district.
One of the more pressing needs that we have right now that we've talked to the body about several times is the need to store evidence.
The department says it also needs more room for administrative staff, detectives, and officers. APD and the administration have said the move spares the city tens of millions of dollars and years of planning that it would take to build a new facility of its own. But Assemblymember Amy Demboski, the lone no vote on the measure, believes it's an inessential expense at a time when crime in the city requires a more direct response.
I'm looking at needs, and to me, this is a want versus a need at this moment. I think everybody's rushing to do it as fast as they possibly can.
With the Assembly's final approval, Chief Dahl anticipates command and administrative staff will begin moving into the new building within 3 weeks. He hopes to have more than 150 employees moved in by January. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the 100-year anniversary of the Princess Sophia marine disaster.
It was peeled, it was shaved. Vanderbilt Reef worked like a cheese grater on the bottom of the hull.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
In an unprecedented event, 2 minor earthquakes shook the coast of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta last night. The quakes hit about 45 miles offshore of the community of Hooper Bay. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports seismologists are looking closer at the unusual event.
Earthquakes are common in Alaska. Dozens are registered each day. State seismologist Michael West says his team often knows where to expect them and why they are occurring.
In some sense, unless they're big, we kind of yawn.
But they had a different reaction Tuesday night when 2 quakes shook communities along the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta coast.
Where the heck did that come from?
Earthquakes are rare in southwest Alaska, and quakes have never been recorded anywhere within 100 100 miles of where they struck. The first quake registered at a 4.9 magnitude and hit at 10:42 p.m.
We would consider that to be the main shock.
The second quake was less powerful, registering at a 3.6 and hitting a half hour later at 11:12 p.m.
Based on its location and timing, we would consider that an aftershock.
Early evidence suggests that the quakes align with faults that lie several hundred miles to the east of the epicenter offshore from the delta.
But that's kind of a long way to extrapolate, so we're still, we're going to spend a little time looking into this one.
People living in coastal YK communities felt both quakes as minor tremors, and nobody's reported damage or injury. Jan Olson was just sitting down to watch TV in Hooper Bay when he felt his house move.
I thought somebody was coming up the steps and shook the house.
But no one came in the door. Olson has little kids and thought one of them might have been jumping on a bed. Then the VHF crackled.
We start hearing on the radio, did anybody feel that? Is that an earthquake?
In Makoriak on Nunavik Island, Amanda Shavings had a similar experience at home with her husband.
We're just sitting down and I started rocking, or my couch started rocking.
At first, Shavings thought the house was shaking from the strong winds that blow across the island. But those shutters are short, and this movement kept going.
I looked over to my husband, thinking that he might have been pushing, playing around with the couch, but when I looked at him, I could see him shaking.
They realized what was happening. Immediately, Shavings and her husband searched the web for a tsunami warning. None appeared. Meanwhile, Facebook started filling up with posts about the quake. Shavings works for the Makoriak tribe, and one of her duties is to create an emergency plan for the community, including earthquake response, has now become a priority. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The state will postpone culvert work on the Seward Highway that would have closed the roadway tonight. The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities says inclement weather will delay the work until spring. Department spokeswoman Jill Reese says high winds, blowing rain, freezing temperatures, and the possibility of snow are in the forecast. The closures just south of Girdwood were scheduled to begin tonight. Road officials planned closures in six-hour increments for parts of six nights between the hours of 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Wind gusts to 50 miles per hour hit Tuesday, forcing work to stop. The Seward Highway is the only roadway connecting Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, which includes the cities of Seward, Soldotna, Kenai, and Homer. A popular creek near Petersburg could soon be getting restored by the U.S. Forest Service. For decades, trees in a floodplain near the creek weren't growing right. KFSK's Angela Denning followed a hydrologist through the forest to discover what went wrong and what can be done to fix it.
Omer Creek is a popular waterway about 20 miles south of Petersburg by road. Anglers fish for salmon and trout in the creek, and there's a trail nearby through some old-growth forest. But further up the creek, it's a different story.
I was wandering through this floodplain for several years, and something was just not right.
Heath Whitaker is a hydrologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Petersburg. He's taking a small group of people on a tour of the creek to discover why this part of the forest looks a little different.
I'm not going to tell you, and we're going to try to figure it out on the way.
It's not too long before rain comes pouring down. If we were under large trees, we'd have some protection. But here, the trees are unusually small. Whitaker says the area used to be home to the island's largest spruce trees, but about 20 acres of it was harvested in the early 60s.
If this were harvested in 1962, how big do you think those spruce would be in 56 years?
Bigger.
They'd be this big, you know, they'd be big. And so that always bothered me about this site is why are these trees so small?
As we ponder the reason for the stunted trees, we start walking on an old, overgrown roadbed. Whitaker points out some standing water along the sides. The land and stream start to change. The spread-out flood water becomes more stable. The elevation is a little higher, and there are larger pieces of rock around.
This is where it kind of shifts character. From this point downstream, it really shifts character.
We continue near the creek, climbing up and down what seem like berms in the forest.
Take a look at the water level right there. That is above the level of this.
Below the high banks of the creek, the forest floor drops in elevation to a soggy floodplain.
You don't see this kind of land feature in a normal stream situation, and so it's always bothered me in this particular floodplain, like, why is the elevation so much lower on the floodplain as it is within the channel? Why do we have these dike features right here?
In the trees, we find some larger boulders and an old-fashioned, rusted-out pickup truck. Both are unusual, unnatural. Clues, Whitaker says, that things have been moved around. So what was it?
Mining.
Mining? That's a good guess. Matter of fact, that's close enough. They mined it for the cobble and the gravel for the roadbed for Mitkoff Highway in the 1950s.
The low, soggy areas now were pits back then where gravel was dug up. And the replanted trees aren't growing back strong because they lack proper nutrition. About a meter to 3 meters of topsoil was removed. So the mystery is solved. Well, not entirely. There's still the question about what to do about it. How do present-day hydrologists make waterways better after humans messed them up years ago? The options are limited without making things worse. But Whitaker says they do want to provide more structure and soil to the area.
What I'm hoping is that if we have a helicopter in the area, that we can have that helicopter drop big logs in kind of perpendicular piles to the flow so that at least we've roughened the floodplain a little bit.
The Forest Service also has plans to restore parts of the creek's channel itself. That can be as simple as dropping large trees along the creek banks and letting nature take its course. But although the idea is simple, it's not cheap. They plan to do the project in 2020, but that will depend on funding, which could come through a future timber sale. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The NN Cannery in Naknek was in operation almost continuously from 1895 until 2015. Now, a history project aims to research and record cannery culture. In early October, 19 students at Bristol Bay High School took part in a digital storytelling workshop to document stories of the people who worked there. KDLG's Izzy Ross has more.
The workshop is called Voices from the Past, Digital Storytelling for the Future. Part of the NN Cannery History Project, its goal is to tell the stories of people involved with the cannery. Each student produced a short video on part of cannery life, interviewing everyone from food cart workers to fishermen. Alicia Osborne explored the mug-up tradition.
When my dad worked at a cannery, I went to the mess hall to eat and sometimes went to mug-up too. It was exciting because there was lots of people.
Well, when we use that term mug-up, everyone knows it means time for coffee or tea. Mom and grandma would say, chayuk, have some tea.
And they'd have breakfast. And then they would work from 8 o'clock until 10 o'clock, and they had a mug-up. About a 15-minute break to have mug-up. And then, of course, they had lunch at
19 community members participated, their interviews interspersed with grainy footage and photographs of cannery workers. As part of the project, students also heard from each other. Here's Nathan Hansen.
My topic is about the fisherman's perspective, and we interview people and we ask them about, or I ask them about how they fished and what they did and what was different back in the day. I liked interviewing my grandpa a lot. I don't know, I just got to know him a little bit more.
The short videos are powerful in part because the students, raised in the industry, are examining their place in it. Carly Eldridge's project looks at women's experiences in the fishery.
I grew up set netting in Naknek, and for the past 2 years, I have subsistence fished with my dad. As a young female in this fishery, I have learned many things I think are important to share with you.
The project builds on a legacy of cultural preservation. It was inspired by Tuktwa, an historical magazine of the Bristol Bay area, which Bristol Bay High School students produced in the 1970s and 80s. Along with Marie Aisma of Sea Stories, Larice Egli assisted the students. She said their work provides a glimpse into part of the fishery that has often been overlooked.
There's almost no record that has been developed
in academia that really tells the story of the cannery worker. And so that's part of the focus of this project, is to really shine a light on daily cannery life.
The NN Cannery History Project received an underrepresented communities grant from the National Park Service. And director Katie Ringsmith decided to put $10,000 toward what would become the digital storytelling workshop. The Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation matched that money.
What we want to reinforce with the students is that their history matters, that they come from a place that has extraordinary history, and it's important not just to Bristol Bay, but to Alaska, as well as the entire nation.
I spoke from an era of sail, wind and sail, into power in 1952.
Women's roles were very limited. You either worked in the mess hall.
About a 15-minute break to have.
These projects, informed by the students' experience growing up around the cannery, contribute to a fuller understanding of the people who worked there. As for Ringsmith and Egley, they are already planning next year's class. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
This week marks the 100th anniversary of Alaska's worst maritime disaster. The steamship Princess Sophia headed down Lynn Canal with over 350 passengers and crew bound for Juneau. But shortly after departing Skagway, the doomed ship ran aground on Vanderbilt Reef north of Juneau. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story. It's part one of two, and it takes us back to late October 1918.
The gold rush of decades earlier was now flowing the other way. Business people, riverboat crewmen, soldiers heading to France, civil servants, miners, and laborers. Ginny Hall's great aunt and family were among those preparing to leave Dawson City for a southern vacation.
And of course, the percentage of passengers on the last boats out of the season was higher because people would wait until the very end of the season if they could.
Vancouver author Betty O'Keefe says others planned on never coming back.
The fact that it was an unusually large number of people were leaving at that time, people who had been in the North for years and years and years, and that was due to the economic downturn that had already taken place.
Riverboat passengers boarded the train in Whitehorse for the ride down to Skagway. One of the vessels preparing for the trip south was the Princess Sophia, a 245-foot double-hulled steamer operated by Canadian Pacific Railway Company. It was outfitted to safely take on more than the usual 250 passengers. October 23rd's evening departure was delayed because of the crowds and congestion on the Skagway docks. Probably in an effort to make up some time, Captain Leonard Locke ordered a speed close to 12 knots down Taya Inlet. It was the middle of the night. North winds were picking up, and it was snowing heavily. Mariners relied on dead reckoning then, and those traveling down Lynn Canal usually took a bearing off of the Sentinel Island light. The Princess Sophia's crew never saw it, and they certainly didn't see the small unlighted buoy on the south side of Vanderbilt Reef, two-thirds of the way down the channel. Still, O'Keefe says the crew probably wasn't too concerned.
I think the fact that Captain Locke was 65 years old, he'd done the route hundreds of times. He probably felt in his own mind he knew it well enough to sail it blindfolded. And that, in combination with a very severe storm, heavy winds, combination of things put him a mile and a half off course, and that's when they hit the reef.
The grounding itself was not catastrophic. The crew and passengers, most of which were already in bed, were bumped and bruised. The vessel appeared to be resting firmly and nearly straight and even on the flat-topped reef. No panic, no cause for concern. The passengers were still relatively warm and dry. Captain Locke telegraphed his situation to a company agent in Juneau. Just another in a series of groundings for the Princess Sophia, and according to Juneau diver John Lackalt, it was just another inconvenience.
When the radio message was received that the Sophia was on Vanderbilt Reef, everybody did another grounding. You know, I mean, it was no big deal because it happened all the time. There was so many vessels that happened up either on that reef or Sentinel Reef or Sentinel Island.
Vessels from Juneau were recruited to help in a possible evacuation of the passengers, and accommodations for their stay in Juneau were arranged. The Sophia's sister ship, the Princess Alice, shoved off from Vancouver to help. At least 8 boats, including the lighthouse service vessel Cedar, mail boat Estebeth, and fishing vessel King and Wing, eventually arrived at the reef and stood by in case the weather moderated further. But it never did.
And the barometer kept rising, and the winds started coming out of the north, and it hit gale, well more than gale. There were estimates that the wind had hit over 80 miles an hour out of the north. It was really screaming. Seas got real big.
Rescue boats took shelter. James Delgado of the Vancouver Maritime Museum says those winds and seas took their toll on the Princess Sophia after nearly 40 hours on the reef.
Vanderbilt Reef worked like a cheese grater on the bottom of the hull.
The radio operator telegraphed his last desperate messages. Historian Ken Coates says it was at that point that panic consumed everyone on board.
It's all of a sudden tipping very dramatically. You can imagine the people screaming, you can imagine the noises, the grinding of the ship on the rocks, the wind is howling, the weather's now turned ferociously cold, and they know they're going down.
Now heading north, the vessel then slipped backwards beneath the waves. Water flooded into the engine room. The boilers exploded. Passengers and crew had no time to put on life jackets or get into lifeboats. The following morning, the weather eased enough for rescuers to approach the reef, but they were stunned by what they saw. The Princess Sophia was gone. The only visible remnant was the very top of the foremast sticking out of the water just south of the reef. Over 340 men, women, and children were missing and presumed dead. Amid all the grief, there were many questions, but only one survivor, which was unable to tell rescuers more about what happened that terrifying night. A dog that belonged to a passenger scrambled ashore and was found 2 days later. But in a world already accustomed to death, the tragedy faded from the public consciousness almost as fast as the vessel slipped beneath the waves. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
That story originally aired in 2002. Part 2 aims to answer this question: could the disaster have been prevented? And why, after 100 years, is the Princess Sophia tragedy largely forgotten in Alaska and the Yukon? We'll have that on tomorrow's Alaska News Nightly. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Abby Collins, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Matt Miller in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.